Today is Wednesday, August 4th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedo for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Taliban adopts new attack strategy in Afghanistan.
Before that, they were sweeping through districts that were relatively unpopulated, a little bit more remote.
Plus, the UN accuses Iraq of the widespread torture of detainees.
The problem is the government has not implemented the procedural safeguards to prevent torture, and so the practice continues throughout the country.
Also, growing fears of famine in the Tigray region. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. A blast near the office of Afghanistan's main security agency wounded at least three people on Wednesday, hours after a bomb and gun attack on a minister's compound brought surging Taliban violence to the capital. Maha Al-Badrawi of Reuters reports.
Two blasts shook high security areas of Afghanistan's capital city, Kabul, late Tuesday night and again early Wednesday morning. The second blast wounded civilians and a security official near a National Directorate of Security compound, according to police. That came hours after a car bomb exploded and gunfire erupted late Tuesday night, killing several civilians near Kabul's diplomatic district, in a heavily fortified area of the city known as the Green Zone. A senior security official said Tuesday's attackers appeared to be targeting the home of acting Defense Minister Bismillah Mohammadi. All of the attackers died in the blast, according to an Interior Ministry spokesperson. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the Tuesday blast, while no group has yet claimed responsibility for the Wednesday attack. Minutes after Tuesday night's blast, hundreds of civilians in Kabul took to the streets and chanted Allahu Akbar, meaning God is the greatest in Arabic, in support of Afghan security forces and against the Taliban. They carried candles and Afghan flags to signal opposition to the extremist group, as they've stepped up offenses in recent weeks. Attacks have risen sharply since US President Joe Biden announced American troops would leave Afghanistan by September, after 20 years of war.
That's Maha Al-Badrawi of Reuters. Afghan government forces launched airstrikes Tuesday, backed by the U.S., in a desperate effort to defend the city of Lashkar-e-Gah from Taliban fighters. The development came as the militant group pressed ahead with its rapid advance across southern Afghanistan. It has now captured 9 out of 10 districts of the Helmand provincial capital. Lashkar-e-Gah residents say the fighting has them trapped, hunkered down inside their homes and unable to step out for basic supplies. AP correspondent Kathy Ganon reports the Taliban has sweet tactics in its advance.
The Taliban are advancing on provincial capitals, three particular provincial capitals, two in the south of Afghanistan and one in the west. Now, this is the change that has occurred in the last 3, 4, 5 days. Before that, they were sweeping through districts that were relatively unpopulated, a little bit more remote.
The rise of violence between the Taliban and the Afghan government forces has triggered a new influx of Afghan refugees to Turkey. VOA's Arif Aslan reports from Turkey's Van province in this story narrated by Namo Al-Jaff.
These people have arrived in Turkey's Van province after walking for over 20 hot summer days from Afghanistan and Iran. They are among thousands of Afghans who recently fled their country due to a surging armed confrontation between the Afghan government and the Taliban.
We spend the nights out in the mountains, and during the days we have to walk under the sun with no food and water. Blisters are all over our feet. It is cold at night, cold, and it is hot during the days.
Turkish officials in Van say they have registered over 34,000 refugees crossing from Iran, with Afghans making up the majority. Nearly 1,500 refugees and 11 smugglers have been detained for illegal crossing.
Refugees crossing the border are often sent back across the border when they are caught by Turkish guards. This is not a legal situation. This is illegal. Once people have crossed the border and entered into Turkey, the police or gendarmerie who caught them must register them into the system after completing the processes such as identifying those people and taking their fingerprints.
BOA has learned that smugglers often transfer the Afghans at night from dangerous routes across Pakistan's Balochistan province into Iran and then to Turkey. Children are most vulnerable in this journey toward the final destination, Europe.
We walk the whole night without knowing where we are going. We walk through the deserts and roads. The stray dogs were wandering around us. The kids got really scared. The dogs chased us and we were this much close to grabbing the kids. We went to a mosque and slept for 2 hours and then hit the road again. May God help us.
Nearly 3 million refugees and asylum seekers in the world are Afghans. The International Organization for Migration estimates that the number of Afghans crossing the border illegally has increased by 30 to 40% since May, when international forces began withdrawing from Afghanistan and the Taliban increased its attacks. For Arif Aslan, reporting from Van, Turkey, this is Namu Abdullah, VOA News, Washington.
Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman told the Senate panel Tuesday that the Biden administration support repeal of the 2002 congressional authorization for the war in Iraq, saying it is no longer necessary to protect Americans or U.S. national security interests abroad. But some Republican senators expressed concern, saying repeal of the so-called War Powers Authorization could send the wrong message to adversaries like Iran. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
19 years after the U.S. Congress authorized U.S. military intervention in Iraq against then-leader Saddam Hussein, Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Menendez told the panel that the authorization of the use of military force against Iraq, abbreviated as AUMF, is obsolete. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez.
It simply makes no sense to keep an authorization against Iraq. The Biden administration has made clear through a formal statement of administration policy that it is not relying on the 2002 AUMF for ongoing operations or detention authority. Logically, as the terms of the AUMF applied only to threats emanating from Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman made clear that the Biden administration also supports the repeal of the 2002 military authorization.
The fact is, the 2002 AUMF is no longer necessary to protect the American people from terrorism, to respond to attacks on our personnel or facilities, or to ensure the safety and security of our people. The president has other tools available to achieve these objectives.
But some senators oppose the repeal, including ranking Republican member James Risch.
Coupled with troop reductions across the Middle East, I'm concerned that the repeal of the 2002 AUMF only adds to the wrong message the administration, and I think all of us, are already sending to Iran, our allies in the region.
Another Republican senator strongly disagreed, Senator Rand Paul.
We shouldn't have 1,000 troops in Mali. We shouldn't have 1,000 troops in Somalia. We shouldn't be in 14 different countries. But if we replace it, all of the replacements of 2001 authorization have been still broad enough to be interpreted to include all the places we're involved with. Dozens of wars could be fought with most of the replacement bills. So I'd say repeal them all. War is supposed to be something that's difficult to get involved with.
President Joe Biden has said the U.S. combat mission in Iraq will end by the end of this year. And he is also withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan after 20 years there. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The United Nations accuses the government of Iraq of the widespread torture of detainees. A UN report covers conditions in the country's detention centers from July 1, 2019 to April 30, 2021. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Torture and ill treatment are prohibited under international law. Iraq ratified the International Convention Against Torture in 2011 and since has enacted national laws criminalizing torture. The problem is the government has not implemented the procedural safeguards to prevent torture, and so the practice continues throughout the country. That assessment in a report released Tuesday by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq is based on interviews that the authors conducted with 235 people deprived of their liberty. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Marta Hurtado says more than half of those interviewed provided accounts of having been tortured or ill-treated while in custody. She says some detainees described beatings by officers with metal pipes or of being shocked with exposed electrical wires. One inmate, she says, spoke of having his handcuffs hooked on a chain and hung from the ceiling.
The report states that legal procedures designed to bring interrogations and detention under judicial control within 24 hours of the initial arrest are not respected. And access to a lawyer is systematically delayed until after suspects have been interrogated by the security forces.
Hurtado says torture is used to extract confessions and access to a lawyer is systematically delayed until after suspects have been interrogated by security forces. She says the location of 17 official detention sites remains opaque.
The report also raises concerns that the authorities ignore complaints and signs of torture, and says that the system established to address official complaints appear to be neither fair not effective. The report also says that the limited accountability for such failures on the part of the authorities suggests acquiescence and tolerance of these practices.
The report calls on Iraqi authorities to put the nation's anti-torture legal framework fully in line with international human rights law, particularly the United Nations Convention Against Torture. Commenting on the report, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the prevention of torture, and not just on paper, would contribute to peace and stability in the long term. Bachelet adds such an outcome is in the interest of the state as well as the victims. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the COVID-19 Delta variant sweeps through southern U.S. states, which have low vaccination rates, doctors with the Infectious Diseases Society of America are calling for more testing and more vaccinations, both in the U.S. and in other countries. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
The Delta variant was first detected in India, but it's rapidly spreading around the world. In the U.S., it's fueling at least 80% of new outbreaks, mainly among those who are not vaccinated. The variant can affect even those who have received the COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Ricardo Franco says the Delta variant makes up an even higher number of new COVID infections at the University of Alabama Hospital. He put the number there at 89%. He added that nearly all patients at his hospital are not vaccinated against the virus.
The key here is that the overwhelming majority of infections are occurring among the unvaccinated. Data from COVID Tracker shows that a vaccinated person is 8 times less likely to get infected by the Delta variant compared to an unvaccinated person. It is 25 times less likely to be hospitalized, and if hospitalized, 25 times less likely to die from COVID-19.
Franco cited the New York Times COVID tracker that shows case rates in low vaccination areas are higher than in areas of high vaccination.
The conclusion here is that vaccination is working through this Delta wave. And more importantly, unvaccinated people are actually benefiting from greater herd immunity protection in high vaccination counties compared to low vaccination ones.
Franco said herd immunity should increase as more people get vaccinated. But there's a problem with the data because fewer tests are being performed and many testing centers in the U.S. have closed. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel from the University of Pennsylvania said without testing, it's hard to know where the variant is spreading and who is spreading it.
And so we really don't have a good handle on the frequency of asymptomatic, but nevertheless apparently transmissible infections with Delta.
Emanuel said that without widespread testing, new variants will be missed both in the U.S. and elsewhere.
We have to stop being U.S. focused alone, because these variants, you know, in the case of Delta, arose overseas and came here. And so getting the world vaccinated is a top priority and has to be a top priority. We don't know where a new one is going to evolve.
Until the virus is stopped, Emanuel said the best protection is wearing a mask at public places indoors and even outdoors in large crowds. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Tuesday issued a new 60-day moratorium on residential evictions in areas with high levels of COVID-19 infections, citing the raging Delta variant after having rejected an earlier push by the White House. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
The Biden administration announced a new limited moratorium banning home evictions in the U.S. for another 60 days, based on areas hit hard by the coronavirus. A temporary ban on evictions expired a few days ago and put millions of people at risk of living on the street. Progressive politicians like Cori Bush, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Elizabeth Warren fought to keep the moratorium, which yielded a success. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued Tuesday's order for areas with high levels of COVID-19, covering about 90% of the nation's population. The CDC said it will expand protections to other areas if they see a rise in infections, as the Delta variant sweeps the country, mostly in the South. According to an Aspen Institute study, more than 15 million people and nearly 7 million households are behind on rental payments and collectively owe more than $20 billion to landlords. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said in a statement, quote, "This moratorium is the right thing to do to keep people in their homes and out of congregate settings where COVID-19 spreads." This new order protects renters through October 3rd, but almost certainly faces legal challenges. The National Apartment Association, which manages nearly 10 million rental units, sued the government last week for billions of dollars in unpaid rent. The group called the CDC's new order, quote, "an unfunded government mandate that forces housing providers to deliver a costly service without compensation and saddles renters with insurmountable debt." Biden has said the extension would give the federal government time to distribute unused, congressionally approved funds, over $40 billion, to help pay unpaid rent and ultimately keep people in their homes. He also acknowledged the legal risks of moving ahead, but said he'll leave it up to the courts.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Southeast Asian foreign ministers have picked Brunei's second foreign minister as their special envoy to Myanmar in a breakthrough after months of delay for regional mediation to help end the country's deepening crisis. In a joint statement after their annual meeting, foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian said Erwan Yusuf will begin his work in Myanmar to build trust and confidence with full access to all parties concerned. The British Navy says hijackers who boarded a vessel off the coast of the United Arab Emirates in the Gulf of Oman have left the ship without elaborating. The notice on Wednesday came after the British military's United Kingdom maritime trade operations warned of a, quote, potential hijack, unquote, under unclear circumstances the night before. The group reported that the vessel was safe. It did not provide further details about the event, which unfolded amid heightened tensions between Iran and the West over Iran's tattered 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The United Nations Children's Agency has said that more than 100,000 children in Ethiopia's northern region of Tigray could suffer life-threatening malnutrition in the next 12 months, a tenfold increase to normal numbers. This report is produced by Soroya Ali of Reuters.
More than 100,000 children in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region could suffer life-threatening malnutrition in the next 12 months. That's according to the United Nations Children's Agency, who says they're about to run out of the formula used to treat 4,000 severely malnourished children every month. UNICEF spokesperson Marixi Mercado at a news conference Friday.
As UNICEF reaches areas of Tigray that were inaccessible in past months due to insecurity, our worst fears about the health and well-being of children in that conflicted region of northern Ethiopia are being confirmed. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced. Food stores have been looted. Without sufficient humanitarian assistance, child malnutrition will rise beyond the already alarming levels, leading to increased risk of mortality among a vulnerable population.
The UN says that around 400,000 people are living in famine conditions in Tigray, where fighting between rebellious regional and federal forces has continued since November. Spokespeople for the Prime Minister and a government task force on Tigray did not immediately respond to requests for comment on UNICEF's statement. Doctors in two hospitals in the region said they saw between 4 to 10 severely malnourished children monthly before the conflict erupted. Now, those numbers have more than doubled. At least 3 children have died in Wukro Hospital since February, according to one nurse. The UN says that Tigray needs 100 trucks of food daily to prevent mass starvation. Only 50 trucks have gotten through in the past month.
That's Roya Ali of Reuters. Human Rights Watch has issued a report saying strong evidence suggests some Lebanese officials were aware of and tacitly accepted the danger posed by improperly stored ammonium nitrate at Beirut's port. A blast at the port late August 4th left nearly 220 people dead and swaths of the capital in ruins. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman on the findings and how some Lebanese are coping with the blast's aftermath.
The Human Rights Watch report found evidence implicating a number of Lebanese authorities as criminally negligent under Lebanese law for causing the disaster, recorded as one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. It has also called for an investigation by the UN Human Rights Council and for those implicated to face sanctions. Aya Majoub is the Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch Beirut. She told VOA that the report was given to Lebanese officials, but only a few responded and with denials of responsibility.
There wasn't a single Lebanese official who accepted any responsibility for their role in such a huge catastrophe. We're calling on the UN Human Rights Council to dispatch an investigative mission to investigate the Beirut blast, including who is responsible, besides individual responsibility, what the Lebanese state's responsibility to act was, and how they failed in their obligations to protect the public human rights.
The International Rights Group also says systemic problems in Lebanon's legal and political system are allowing officials to avoid accountability. Rampant corruption has eroded Lebanon's governing system. Analysts and activists alike have called for the corruption in the system to be uprooted. According to the Reuters news agency, the presidential palace offered no response when contacted about the report. Other senior officials also did not comment. Many Lebanese, meanwhile, continue to struggle with the destruction and the loss of loved ones in the trauma that ensued. A Lebanese Catholic nun, Sister Marlene Youssef of the Daughters of Charity organization, runs a nonprofit school for 300 students in Beirut's Ashrafieh district, about a kilometer above the port area. The nun says she was on the roof of the connecting convent when she saw a fire in the port and heard a loud explosion. She told VOA the scene frightened her and that she ran into an elevator to go down. She was inside the lift when the second massive blast erupted, and being inside it is what saved her. Her sole colleague, another nun named Sister Sophia, was not as fortunate. Sister Marlene Youssef is in the process of rebuilding the premises and her life. 67-year-old Walid Taha says he had been fishing near the port and got into his car when the powerful second explosion struck. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
China's worst coronavirus outbreak since the start of the pandemic a year and a half ago has escalated, with dozens more cases around the country. One city has been sealed off, and local officials blamed for lack of pandemic measures will be punished. Since the initial outbreak was tamed last year, China's people lived virtually free of the virus, with extremely strict measures stamping out small flare-ups. Now the country is on high alert, as a cluster of cases caused by the Delta variant touched at least 17 provinces. That's That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, moderator for Issues in the News. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the U.S. reached President Biden's goal of getting at least one COVID-19 shot into 70% of American adults as the Delta variant surges throughout the country. Listen to Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.